Hello, it's Fraser from Unbreak My Chart on a slightly muffled microphone. I just wanted to say we have made a Spotify playlist of all the songs that we're discussing in this week's podcast, and it's available from the program notes that come with the podcast. We will be doing this every week from now on, so you can hear in full the songs that we are dissecting. Enjoy this week's show.
Welcome to Unbreak My Chart, the podcast that tapes the top 10 and talks about it at school the next day. I'm Laura Snapes.
And I'm Fraser McAlpine.
How are you doing, Fraser?
I'm really well. I'm really well. With so much to talk about this week. It's remarkable that we thought that this chart would be kind of, you know, just a quick scoot through the top 10 and then, you know, a bit of a recommendation of songs that we like and then off, skipping gaily away. But there's stuff going on all the time. It's like a fermenting brewing beer or something like that. It's a terrible analogy, but that's what it's like.
We've also had our own chart experience this week. I now understand vaguely what it must be like to be Ed Sheeran. We were briefly the number one music podcast in the UK, and we made it to number 147 in the real podcast charts, which was terribly exciting. But I think we have bombed out again now, because the podcast chart is based on a totally different kind of metric to the singles chart even.
Yes, well, it's based on velocity of take up. So if you have 1,000 people listening to your podcast and then the following week you gain 100 listeners, that counts as a certain achievement. But if you have no listeners and then you gain 100 listeners, that's a far greater achievement, proportionally speaking. So that will catapult you further up. So we were number one for like 36 hours, 48 hours. And which was, you know, thematically, if nothing else, was very gratifying. But it's interesting because straight away, We were both like going, this isn't right. We haven't got the biggest, we're not bigger than these other podcasts that are in
Tiesto.
There. Yeah, Song Exploder. We're not doing better than any of these. So how come we're number one? And then you sort of drill down. So it is that weird thing, because we've been spending so much time talking about how the charts are manipulated in various different parts of the world, and, you know, the singles charts and whether it's singles should be singles and all of that. For it to happen directly to us almost as soon as we've started talking about it was quite a strange moment. But, you know, high fives to everybody. Thank you so much for coming on board. You know, let's see if we can get back up there for reals this time.
And yeah, you can subscribe on iTunes, because we are there properly now. And you can still email us at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. We've got some listener emails coming later on. And you can tweet us both as well. I'm at Laura Snapes and Fraser is
at CSI _popmusic. As Laura said, we've had a couple of emails in, and the first is from Sophie Appleby. And in true Radio 2 style, she starts by saying that she's very much enjoying the podcast, which is always very gratifying to hear. She says, however, I wish it had started just 1 week earlier, because I found the charts from the 3rd to the 9th of March very exciting. I really love Stormzy. I think his album's great, apart from the rubbish Stevie Wonderish ones. That's her brackets, not mine. I'm not editorialising. And when 7 tracks from this album got into the top 40, I was like, this is amazing. Grime has gone mainstream. This is the biggest youth cultural movement since Britpop. The charts reflect what everyone is listening to. And brilliantly, everyone is listening to Stormzy. And then the Sheeran singularity happened. And I was like, oh, the charts are just broken. I was wondering what your thoughts are on this. Well, first of all, I don't think the charts are necessarily broken. I think that's an important thing to take away. They are weird at the moment, and we'll get on to why they're weird this week in a second. But I think the charts are always a reflection of what people are doing. So they started off being a reflection of what music people were buying. And they've in recent years become a reflection of what music people are actually listening to, which is a massive paradigm shift in what they actually reflect. There is a slight problem when they don't seem to be fair in the sense of dividing up the spoils of what people are listening to according to various artists and you know, really sharing it out. So when there are moments of dominance, like, you know, like with Ed Sheeran, it looks like they're not doing their job properly. And maybe there are ways in which you could say, okay, well, we know that Ed Sheeran's album is massive at the moment. We could reflect that within the charts just by looking at the singles and not having all of the tracks from the album dominate the top 40. So there are ways that you can sort of artificially allow songs to represent larger entities, which is traditionally what has happened. But I don't think they're broken. I don't. I think it's really interesting at the moment that the three big artists of the year so far, if you go on the singles charts, are artists that 5 years ago nobody had heard of, possibly with the exception of Drake, who was up and coming. But you know, this is sort of proof of a vibrant top 40 culture where things are changing. Whether these things then go on to have cultural heft in the wider sense doesn't matter, because the top 40 is, you know, designed to be here today and gone tomorrow. So I don't necessarily think they're broken. With Stormzy in particular, I agree. I thought the week that his album, everything that Stormzy has done with the top 40, whether it's taking, you know, one of his recorded Wicked Skeng Man 4 into the top 40 was a real achievement. It's based on, you know, ground street level popularity, and he is unequivocally great. So he's, you know, that all of that stuff felt like a reward for hard work. So in a sense, I completely agree, and in a sense, I completely disagree. Laura, what do you think?
I think the charts are proof that everybody is still listening to Stormzy and Skepta and so on. Like, if you look at Ed Sheeran and Drake being in the top 10, they're both massively influenced by those artists. Drake more kind of explicitly, I think, on his new mixtape. Playlist, which we'll get onto. And Ed Sheeran, although you can't really hear the grime influence on the songs that are in the top 10, which are the particularly sappy ones, I would say, he has made kind of like great play of his connections to that scene. And also, you could kind of say that it's a bit contrived, but they love him back. You know, he's got Stormzy performing with him at the Brit Awards. So yeah, I think the 3 weeks ago I might have agreed with you and said I do think the charts are broken, but actually the more that we've dug down into it, the more exciting it is. And it's small excitements. It's like Fraser was saying, it's like watching beer brew, but just seeing things bubble up through the charts, like Anne-Marie kind of breaking into the top 10 and Martin Jensen's solo dance getting up there as well. The movement is granular, but it's less predictable, and I think that is good fun.
Yeah, definitely. And this week is particularly strange because we're 2 weeks after the Sheeran singularity, and we're now into what we're going to have to call the dread duality, which is a compound of Drake and Ed, because Drake's what is it, Laura? Is it an album? Is it a playlist? Can you explain the album thing? It's a playlist. Now, why is it a playlist and not an album?
I think he's just said that he's not really feeling albums. He wanted to make a playlist. I think really what it is he put out Views last year, which was a massive album. It was really solipsistic. It was really, really narcissistic, self-serving, grumpy, bitter kind of Drake. And it was critically maligned, but it was massively popular. And I get the impression with More Life that I think he said he wants to make music for people's lives. So I think that's where the playlist element of it comes in that it's a record that can do lots of different things without having to kind of justify itself stylistically. He can explore tons of different sounds. And also it seems a bit like he could have called it a mixtape, but it just seems very like, I'm not like the other rappers with their free mixtapes on Datpiff or Rap Caviar or whatever those websites are. It seems that, I don't know, there's something kind of like sleek and classy and on trend about it. Though I was really surprised actually that it's not, it wasn't platform exclusive. It didn't specifically go out on Apple or Spotify or Tidal or any of the other ones. It arrived on all of them at once, which also feels like an important marketing point that he's decided that he's going to do something that's like egalitarian rather than being tethered to one particular service like somebody like Chance the Rapper is.
Yeah. And there is that thing as well of the bigger you are, the more you need every new release to feel like a paradigm shift. It can't just be an album that's come out, a new collection of your great hits. It has to be, you know, a new forward-thinking way of delivering an amount of music, in his case, 22 songs, in a big lump that isn't an album and isn't what has gone before, because, you know, he is a forward-thinking, revolutionary artist. And then some of that is hyperbole, obviously, and some of it, you know, there's an element of actually, I just want to do things my way. And either of those are laudable in their own way. Well, hyperbole is always fun anyway. So of More Life, the playlist stroke album stroke mixtape is 22 songs, 12 of which are in the top 40. So which means that Ed Sheeran and Drake between them account for 24 songs that are in the top 40 at present. But what's interesting about the Drake stuff is that a lot of the songs that are in the top 40 are guest appearance songs. You know, it isn't just that one voice that appears throughout the top 40. That, you know, we'll get into the top 10 in a sec, but the songs that are in the top 10 are, you know, you wouldn't even necessarily spot one of them as being a Drake song.
Yeah, it's a bit of a snippet. I think that's the other thing. You know, Drake has been accused of culture hopping a lot of times and, you know, dabbling in different sounds in this kind of a self-serving way. But I think making an album, releasing an album as a playlist and foregrounding the kind of guest element of it, it's him kind of trying to say, I'm a curator and I'm an appreciator. It's not him trying to dive into those sounds and be all about them.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does justify his claim that this is a different thing from just a very personal, you know, creation of one artist wanting their voice to be at the foreground all the time.
Also, I think it's because obviously with a 22 track playlist across streaming services, the only reason that he's done that is to try and saturate, you know, streaming stats, and he's already broken massive records in America, I think. But when your record is full of guest artists and it's a bit kind of stylistically lighter than the weighty views, it's a way of establishing dominance and that doesn't feel quite so much like a giant pounded fist. It feels a bit more generous. You might not kind of realise the extent of his dominance.
That's been the weird thing about the Ed Sheeran thing, isn't it? It's because it has felt like a giant fist, but a benign one. It's like an iron... It's the opposite of the iron fist in a velvet glove. It's a velvet fist in an iron glove.
Exactly.
He puts himself across as being this really nice man. I'm not going to hurt you, but I am going to hit you really, really hard in the head several times. It might hurt a touch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I am. I'm just an underdog, but me and Taylor Swift have carved up pop, and I'm going to be reigning until she's back at the end of the year, just FYI. Interestingly, I was listening to the New York Times podcast the other day, which is their music podcast, and a couple of weeks ago, they were looking at how weird the American charts are looking at the moment, and they had the... expert chart analyst Chris Melanfi on, and he was saying that now the singles chart over there, it's defined as a consumption chart. It's not based on that old kind of like sales engagement model anymore. It's meant to be a model of like enduring consumption, which I thought was very interesting, and I wonder if we'll see the official charts company recategorized in that way as well. But something else that I learned from that podcast, which I thought was really interesting, was in the UK, any album that's streamed, it counts towards the album charts, but each individual track play counts towards the singles charts as well. Whereas in America, I believe the way it works is that every 10 plays of an artist's single count towards one album play. It registers as one album play. So it's almost the other way around. So I think that would mean you would see more stagnancy in the album's charts, but a more active, less saturated singles chart. And although I disagree with some of the very contrived metrics that the American charts run on, I think I would prefer that way around. That seems more logical to me than every play of a track on an album counting as a singles play. What do you think?
What struck me while you were talking then was that in an instance like with Drake's album, when there are 22 songs on the album, I would have thought 22 plays of the single should count as one album listen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I presume that that metric has just been arrived at as a kind of, there are average somewhere around 10 songs on an album, and therefore the plays should count towards album tallies on the chart. But there are so many albums where 10, they go sailing past 10, and that's halfway through the album. And then, you know, there's a million and one other things to do before you even get to the end. I mean, ultimately, I kind of, yeah, the problem of the chart is that it's for radio programmers, they need to have an interesting rundown. And for people to read a list week on week, it needs to not be stagnant. It needs to not have the same number one for 4 months. And it needs to, with no movement in the top 10 underneath it, unless that's an outlier and that's, you know, worth talking about as a being an interesting moment. And it needs variety, but as a true reflection of what people are actually doing, I'm not sure that singles and albums should be counting towards each other at all. But and I certainly don't. I sort of don't really want to worry about radio programmers and their chart show rundowns and the lists, because I think it should actually reflect what people are really doing. Even if everybody was just listening to the same 40 songs week on week, I kind of think, well, if they're doing that, that's what the chart is. I think the certainly you shouldn't be factoring in anything like radio play, because that's curated content. That's radio programmers, even if they're reacting to people ringing into the radio stations and saying, I want to hear this Ed Sheeran song, please. It's curated. It's a falsely tilted information. It doesn't leaven anything. I think that, you know, I think our singles chart in a way needs to be more granular and less worried about albums. and fold in information from YouTube, which is where younger listeners, I think, or, and people that don't necessarily want to be paying for streaming services, are listening to their pop music. They're going straight to YouTube and watching the videos, and or just listening to the songs that are available, streaming whole albums off of YouTube as well. And I think if you folded that information in and just completely removed it from the issues of copyright and returning funds back to the record label and the artist, and just said, well, that's interesting, but it's not relevant to what people are actually doing, I think the chart would be far more vibrant and more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the heartening thing also is that at a time when you, when we've got these two massive albums, the Ed Sheeran album and the Drake album, that are, that do seem completely dominant, singles are still penetrating the top 10, whether they're entering there or they're crawling up. So I think we should get on to the top 10. So this week at number 10 is Anne-Marie and Ciao Adios, which has been on the charts for 6 weeks, and this is its first time in the top 10.
So this is kind of Anne-Marie's Hold My Hand moment. If you remember, Jess Glynn's Hold My Hand was the first hit she had after she had gained public attention with Clean Bandit singing on Rather Be. And Anne-Marie has worked with Clean Bandit as well. And so there's a kind of leg up that Clean Bandit offer through, you know, through what they do. We're talking about Drake being a kind of curator of sounds and finding people and shining a spotlight. And this is, you know, in a sense, this is what Clean Bandit are doing with all the singers that they've worked with. They've worked with, you know, Louisa Johnson and Nuni Bio and Zara Larsson, who we'll get onto in a minute. Anyway, number nine.
Number nine is Drake, KMT featuring Giggs.
Okay, I got a lock on the streets. Shout out to T the Three. And he brought it in because of me. You don't know nothing about me. Life of my brothers is deep.
A very slight song. And it really shows up kind of the slight weakness of Drake's voice. Like going from him rapping to Giggs rapping is a bit like switching from Alco Pops to Hard Whiskey. It's almost, it's a bit like being smacked in the face when Giggs comes in and you're like, okay, wow, that's a real voice. I kind of like this one. It's very funny, which is obviously all down to Giggs rather than Drake. I particularly like the line, and you already know I love them breasts, looking all perky, looking all Christmas wrapped, looking all turkey.
Yeah, that's and also I have those exact lyrics written down. I think that's an amazing moment. And you're absolutely right. When Giggs comes in, the song stops and starts again. But what's interesting is that Drake worked with Giggs. It sort of shows how deeply involved and interested he is in the grime scene. He's not picking off the current biggest rappers who are doing really well. He's not immediately, I mean, he's working with Skepta, but you know, to work with Giggs shows a certain understanding of what's been going on, that it's a scene that's been around for a longer time than the last year, which you could be forgiven for thinking if you'd only just noticed it. And you know, so the most obvious people to work with would be Skepta or Stormzy or maybe Dizzy Rascal for, you know, heritage points. But to work with Giggs is kind of, he really clearly understands what's been going on here to an extent from an outsider point of view. And also, just a million points for ending your rap with Batman. I just think, you know, there should be more of that. Especially because he's such a seriously voiced man. The gravitas with which he approaches his moment is astonishing. And then, you know, to go out like that is, you know, high fives all around, really.
So at number eight, we have Martin Jensen and Solo Dance, which we have talked about a couple of times. So I tried to investigate, see if there was any other interesting facts that I could learn about this song. Not particularly. One of the predominant facts on the Wikipedia page is that the video stars a variety of dancers who dance throughout the whole video while Martin Jensen plays the music at the back.
Oh, wow. They should sell that to show that to video manufacturers, video directors, as a kind of how-to, because I think that seems like a good format to work to.
I know, it's a shame that the old chart show from which we've stolen our logo, it doesn't still exist. That's the kind of tepid fact that might appear at the bottom of the screen. But I did learn one interesting thing about it, actually. The vocal from this is crowdsourced. So Martin Jensen got popular because he made kind of tropical house remixes in which he repurposed the sounds from viral videos, and then he started making more, well, I don't want to say serious, but, you know, original music. But with this song, he said, I made a live video on Facebook where I asked all my followers to send me some new videos that I could sample. And really, no joke, my DM was on fire. I think I received over 1,000 videos. Crazy. My team and I then sat down and went through all these videos, and in between all of them, there was this girl singing. I then invited her to join me for a studio session, and that is when Solo Dance came to life. The moment I heard our final version, I just had this feeling that it had potential to be a hit. I'm so happy for all the support people are giving it worldwide. So, I mean, it's a great break for whoever this nameless lady is on the track.
Can I just say, for people who find it difficult to hear the self-aggrandizement of pop stars without giggling into their sleeves, a really neat trick is whenever anybody says "my team and I," to substitute the word "mum" for "team." It just really helps.
Yeah, so my feelings on this song haven't really changed. I kind of quite like it until the chorus disappears and you just get that really insipid, wordless part that stands in for saying anything better.
Are you dissing up Martin Jensen's fan from Facebook that provided the insipid the solo vocal part?
No, it's not vocal, it's a synth part. It's where his selected lady disappears for a bit and you just get this boring, noodly synth part. But yes, I stand by what I said last week about it being the focus group dancing on my own. It's like what would happen if you asked the guys from The Apprentice to name a kind of faceless dance banger, solo dance. Also, it sounds like a euphemism, which the lyrics don't really bear out, but I'm sure he's definitely trying to trade on that. He must be.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
So at number 7, we have Ed Sheeran and Perfect. Fraser, do you have any new thoughts on Perfect as it's matured in your mind?
No, it's just the doo-wop thinking out loud. That's all it is.
Moving on. At number 6, here is Clean Bandit, Symphony featuring Zara Larsson. And when you're gone, I feel incomplete. So if you want the truth, I just want to be part of your soul. So number 6 is Clean Bandit with Symphony featuring Zara Larsson.
So Zara Larsson is in the being lifted into the stratosphere by Clean Bandit stage. Even though she's got her own career and it's doing very well and her album's doing really well, there's that kind of brand synergy going on between the two of them, which should, you know, provide a decent lift for people to pay attention to her. And also, this song joins the pantheon of songs about love as if love was music, so which includes "Zing Went the Strings of My Heart" by Judy Garland, "A Cappella" by Khalees, "While My Guitar Gently Weeps" by the Beatles, but not "Trumpets" by Jason Derulo, because that is about sex as music, and it's not even about sensual sex. It's about Benny Hill style pop sexy antics. I just think trumpets aren't, you know, in that instance, they're not a sexy instrument. I think the least you need to get away from the idea of things that sound like that during the act of passionate lovemaking.
I would say that, moving on from that point, Symphony is not a particularly sexy song, but it's a very touching song. I do like the chorus. I've been hearing symphonies before. All I heard was silence, a rhapsody for you and me, and every melody is timeless. Mm. It's very classy. It also has an extremely good video. Have you watched this?
No, I don't watch videos. I don't want to be the old man thing, but I like to... It's that thing of the music, the images in the video interfering with the images that the music makes in your head. So I don't watch them.
It does have a very good video interspersed with clips of Zara Larsson singing as Clean Bandit plays, which looks a little bit, you know, Catherine Jenkins at the proms, but we'll forgive them. there's a nice, the story is of a relationship between two guys, and one of them dies in a biking accident, and the other one is remembering their relationship and paints a bicycle white to go and put out as a tribute to him. And it's very good. And they released it on the day that YouTube launched their restricted mode, which meant that lots of LGBT content suddenly disappeared if you were browsing with parental filters, which was ridiculous. But well done, Clean Bandit and Zara Larsson, because I think that's a very nice video.
Absolutely.
Number 5, Chainsmokers and Coldplay, Something Just Like This.
Well, I mean, we've said it over and over and over. Well done to both of them. You have survived. You are the cockroaches in the nuclear explosion that was Ed Sheeran.
Yeah, they're really holding fast as well. I should say, although we've been praising it for holding on and like slightly staving off Ed Sheeran, I do think this is an atrocious song, and I don't know what Chris Martin is doing. So I really want to temper my appreciation for this.
Well, people don't like cockroaches. I think we've said it. You know, they are. We're interested in them as a statistical anomaly, but as music, well, that's something else.
I'm really interested in what Chris Martin is going to do next, because I'm sure there's been rumours that he'll go solo for years. I mean, not that it'll make a great deal of difference, because, you know, Coldplay are one of those lucky bands that, unless you're the lead singer, you can carry on life in perfect billionaire anonymity.
Yeah, absolutely. And he can't crave plaudits that he isn't getting within Coldplay, other than having Chris Martin written on billboards when he comes up to do gigs, rather than the name of the band. And, you know, I mean, he's appears to be so spectacularly self-effacing that that would actually may even fill in with horror.
Yeah, I really wonder what direction he'd want to take as well, because, you know, being one of those people who likes the first two Coldplay albums, maybe a bit of the third one and none of the others, the kind of like snobby way of thinking is that, like, oh, surely he must want to get back to writing those proper songs. But actually, he seems to be having a perfectly wonderful time doing all this. He doesn't seem coerced, he doesn't seem tortured. So I honestly don't think he would do anything particularly different, but it would be curious to see.
No, well, he's not even going to be able to do the time-honoured indie star becomes pop star thing of working with like a Pharrell or going, you know, exposing his previously hidden disco side, because Coldplay have already done that. I think possibly Chris Martin's going to be absolutely fine, Laura.
Yeah, I'm not worried about him. I'm not worried about his career prospects. He will continue steadily.
So, number four is Passion Fruit by Drake.
Seeing you got ritualistic, cleansing my soul of addiction for now, cause I'm falling apart.
I would say this is the first Drake song I've ever heard that I actually really, really like. I find Drake incredibly irritating. I've never listened to a full Drake album because of that. I don't like One Dance. Hotline Bling is okay. But this I really, really enjoyed, and my reasons for enjoying it are ferociously basic, for which I will apologise. The arrangement sounded a bit like that Jamie XX album that made people really angry, but I liked because it was nice to work to, which I would say is probably not the point of the Jamie XX album.
Or indeed this Drake song either. You've done very well. What you've basically said is, I don't mind this because it doesn't interfere with my concentration.
Exactly, but also, I mean, I really, really don't like his voice, but there's something about the way he sings on this. It's almost like its own little synth patch, like it kind of glowers, and I don't know, there's something slightly like self-effacing about it, and I thought that it fit the title very well. It just feels kind of like very warm and comforting. But yeah, this is faint praise for what Drake's no doubt very highbrow intentions must be.
I think and also what's really, really interesting is that you've seized upon one of the things that people that are find it difficult to get fully into Drake always cite as being the main reason, which is the grain of his voice, which, you know, that there is that thing which sounds somewhere between auto-tune and just having a really unattractive and grain to your voice that grinds away. I find it very hard. I do like him, you know, to an extent. Like you said, you just pick bits that you like because there's so much of it as well. There's a lot of Drake to get through. But it's just that that vocal fry that comes across can be, and it's so monotone as well, that it can be really, really distressing. But I mean, clearly that's something else that helps to facilitate the thought process when you're working. So good, you know, good luck to you.
I think this song is also going to climb and climb and climb. So moving on to the top three, the top three has not changed. At number three is Ed Sheeran with Castle on the Hill. At number two, Galway Girl is Hanging Tight. That's definitely going to be number one at one point, yeah, at some point, yeah, I think. Yeah. And then number one, Shape of You is Hanging On. That's 11 weeks at number one. Do you think it's going to beat Drake from last year, or indeed Bryan Adams from the early 90s?
I still think Galway Girl's going to nobble it just before it gets to the 16-week, you know, moment. But we shall see. It's possible. The thing with Galway Girl now is it's getting a lot of attention as being this, you know, the other track on the Divide album that people are singling out. And I think there's a chance that people will weary of it before they weary of Shape of You, because it is so specific and so, wow, he's gone proper Irish here. Whereas Shape of You is it at least exists as its own metaphor. It's its own thing. It isn't about what musically happens in the song, which it seems a kind of solipsistic way to create music. So I think, yeah, I think it'll, yeah. So basically, either it will or it won't. That seems to be what I'm saying.
Well, I always find it very hard to conjure up the sound of Shape of You in my head. I always forget what it sounds like, whereas I only need to read the words Galway Girl and I have that horrendous song stuck in my head for a day. But I think that Drake and Passion Fruit could eventually climb up and unseat Shape of You before it breaks any records. I think especially given that we're getting into spring, it's getting warmer, I went out without a coat on at the weekend. I think Drake's Passion Fruit is very much, well, it's a song for taking your clothes off, but let's start with, you know, taking your coat off after the winter, and then maybe move on to more items of clothing after that.
Now, is this becoming quite a sexy podcast? I mean, because I just want to know where we're going with this. we don't want to get Jason Derulo involved again. But it does. One of the things that's interesting is that looking over the new releases list for next week, I didn't see anything in there that I thought would even trouble the top 10 particularly, let alone unseat Ed Sheeran from the top. We're really talking about songs that are working their way up rather than things that are arriving that would be so, you know, so powerful as a presence. But there are a few high climbers, aren't there, that have sort of come up the top 40, particularly Issues by Julia Michaels, who's a very interesting person to talk about because she's, you know, a pop songwriter who's worked with lots of other artists and is having her, you know, see a moment, I suppose, to push through to people's actual awareness of her as a person.
Yeah, she's written for Demi Lovato and Fifth Harmony. She wrote tons of Selena Gomez's Revival, tons of Britney Spears' Glory, most of Gwen Stefani's This Is What the Truth Feels Like. She also co-wrote Dive on Ed Sheeran's album. And I think alongside people like Max Martin, she's one of the main songwriters of the moment. 'Cause I got issues, but you got them too. So give them all to me and I'll get mine to you. Bask in the glory. I quite like this. It doesn't really excite me. I would say that, I mean, this is kind of drilling down into a level that nobody will really be appreciating it for, but where a lot of pop at the moment is very kind of triumphalist and us against the odds. I mean, there's a tiny bit of us against the odds in this, but I like that it's kind of relishing in the messiness of a relationship instead of being like, and we will triumph and vanquish. She sings, I got issues, but you got them too, so give them all to me and I'll give mine to you. I mean, it's a bit greetings cardsy, but I like the kind of flagrant messiness of it. It doesn't wrap up in that neat kind of hard armor way.
No, and there's a neat, and actually the one thing I spotted for a professional songwriter, for someone whose job it is to write songs, there's a mixed metaphor in there that really that is either speaks to that chaos or is just badly thought through. But she sings, but you're perfect, poorly wired circuit and got hands like an ocean. Now, you should not be mixing water and electricity. That's a really unsafe thing to do.
But maybe it is a metaphor for the chaos of their relationship, water and electricity.
I would hope so. I mean, you'd hope these things are on purpose. What I do like about her is that she's got a properly worried voice. And I think, as you say, in an era of pop triumphalism, she sounds worried too. It's not like the London Grammar thing of sounding destroyed and being surrounded by, you know, noises of what sound like psychic destruction happening in your own head. She just sounds a bit worried, and I think that will always add an emotive push to a song in which you're discussing, you know, a relationship that's not happening.
It also must be interesting to be in her position. I was reading some interviews with her and she said that when they write the big pop songs, when she collaborates on them, they're often writing to brief. They'll be told what a person's personal situation is and then have to write a song around it. But also she, you know, we're talking about how it's not necessarily pop triumphalism, but she'll be responsible for a great number of the songs that are. And I wonder to what extent you can kind of plot your own breakaway narrative by being like, right, okay, I know what pop's going to sound like for the next year and a half. So if I do this, it'll be something different. How calculated you can be about trying to set yourself apart from all the people whose careers you've essentially created.
That's a fascinating thought. Yes, because obviously they will be after things that sound like things. When the songwriter comes into work, it'll be what have you got? What can we have that's going to do what, you know, whatever the song of the moment is? Which is kind of worrying when you look back at Galway Girl. I wonder if the Cause revival is around the corner. But yes, yeah, so to be able to lead the discussion in that way, or just to zag when everybody else, you know, is zigging, is a valuable thing. I think that she would need to have zagged to a more significant degree than this to truly establish herself as a different voice. It's not like with Sia where, you know, the songs that she was putting out as singles were things that other artists had already rejected because they were too out there. I think this is not too out there, but it's good.
Yeah, it seems like something she's kept because it's personal rather than because it's distinctive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then the other potential big climber for next week is Bruno Mars, That's What I Like. Lucky for you, that's what I like, that's what I like. Lucky for you, that's what I like, that's what I like. Sex by the fire at night, silk sheets and diamonds all white. Lucky for you, that's what I like. How do you feel about this song?
I think it's filled with Donald Trump's chat-up lines, is what I feel about
it. Like, I'll rent a beach house in Miami, wake up with no jammies. Nope.
Nope.
I love that line.
And everything 24 karat. Literally everything is 24 karat. I don't think I would enjoy that. I think, it's that thing of people listing luxurious things that sort of imply they've no first-hand experience of them, but they know that they're luxurious, so you have to have them. Which is, again, why what put me in mind of Trump is because Trump is a man who has the trappings of extreme richness on purpose so that people can look at them and go, right, so you're really, really rich then. Yeah, is that it? You know, so he has gold stuff and he owns the largest building in New York if he can get it. You know, that's it's all about the showing off thing. So this is a chat up. This the whole song is a chat up, but it's a chat up in which someone comes up to you in a bar and says, you don't know this, but I'm amazing. And this is how I'm amazing. And this is all the things that I like. And that's lucky for you because you'll like those things because you're not rich. I'm rich. And I just think as an actual chat up, I don't know. What does it say about the person that's doing the chatting up? What do they think of you as a person if that's how they're chatting you up? They don't think anything about you. They think you're just going to be dazzled by the fact that you've got this stuff. And they're going to submit to your will, which is, again, why I think it's Donald Trump's chat-up line. It's quite a nice, funky song. I'm not anything against that. But lyrically, you're like, really? Okay.
I like the part where he just shouts, like he's singing, I think it's the second verse and it's all going quite smoothly. And then kind of out of nowhere, he just exclaims, I will never make a promise that I can't keep. And it just reminds me of Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch when he had gone a bit mad and like Scientology addled. And it's a bit like, all right, calm down. And like you say, it's like slightly Trumpian as well. Because I would imagine that there are many promises Bruno Mars makes in this song that he can't keep. Like, that every time you have sex, it's going to be all kind of like silk and diamonds and fireplaces, which sounds arduous, if you ask me, having to put in that level of preparation.
Also, diamonds? No diamonds? Don't involve diamonds. You want sort of harder things. I like also that he made it really clear that the sex by the fire, when the sex by the fire happens, it happens at night. That's when you have sex by the fire, at night. He's very clear on that. He puts that in because otherwise people would think, well, why would I want to have sex by the fire? It's sunny out.
Yeah, too hot for that. So, and the other one that might rise up is Zed featuring Alicia Cara and Stay. The clock is ticking, so stay. All you have to do is wait a second. Your hands on mine. The clock is ticking. Alicia Cara, it seems like her career has slightly flopped and now they're going with the, okay, let's pay you with some massive EDM producer people.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. But it's working. So we talked before about people whose careers have hit a bit of a bump and then they've come back, they've gone via the clubs to come back. So Justin Bieber did it and Selena Gomez is doing it to an extent as well. And I think that's good. I think that's actually there's an element of humility to that, which is more than welcome in pop music. Those are all records that are climbing quite high in the charts or with some velocity. And as I said, I did look at the new releases list for the following week, and it's just short on things that I think will have a massive impact. I think the Zayn single, Still Got Time, featuring Party Next Door, has a decent chance of making a splash. Can't give it to me, yeah, yeah, yeah. Can't give it to you, play by play. I can tell you've been bored all day. But you're young and you still got time. Don't waste your time. Won't waste no way, yo. And I'm gonna stay, oh yeah. That smile gonna take you places. And I know you wanna see some places. The lovely thing about the kind of various tropical influence pop songs of recently is that the kind of beat is implied rather than stated. So, that, you know, after that kind of enormously steroidal, four to the floor rush of a lot of EDM and you know, even with Mumford and Sons, it was just that constant pounding bang every beat. To have stuff where there isn't even necessarily drums on the track and but it's still really dancey, it still makes you move and is kind of lovely. Although again, the message of this song is a weird chat up, because he's basically saying to some girl or that he wants to, you know, squirrel away somewhere, that to stop looking for love, don't be looking for anything permanent, you know, from men, but come away with me. And, you know, so the implication is from the start, you come away with me, but I will drop you because, you know, don't be catching feelings now. So it's something that has the smack of liberation, but the taste of just being the same old thing. And, you know, touch of naughtiness with Zayn, there's a possibility that quite a few people would say, that's fine, I probably will stop looking for love. But I just think it's sold as a kind of philosophical conundrum. You know, you're wasting your time looking for love when what you could have is just a few days with me and then going back to your life as always. Fancy it?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't say no. Of course, the big thing that is good that I think actually will unseat Ed Sheeran, maybe it's not going to be Drake, is on Saturday, the Harry Styles debut solo single was announced. And I believe that's coming out on April the 7th. I guess we're not going to hear it until then. But I think that is possibly going to make big waves. I mean, it depends what it sounds like. It sounded a bit kind of like ballady and serious from the tiny clip that was on the advert, but that might be a big red herring.
Yeah, one would hope so, because I think it would necessarily be, unless Harry Styles is trying to throw us off the scent by being serious when you would expect him to be a bit more chipper and lively. But yes, you can't, I mean, who could imagine what a Harry Styles solo single would sound like?
I know, it's kind of make or break for his, well, not make or break, but you know, it'll be interesting to see how it tallies alongside his personality, because he's certainly the breakout star in that I think most people seem to think that he's quite cool. When there was that Observer profile of One Direction a few years ago, he's the one who definitely came off as the most normal, the most relaxed. And he has, yeah, he's, you know, he relaunched his career with his solo career with this big fancy photo shoot on the cover of another magazine, where he let them dress him up in all different ways, kind of like as a young Mick Jagger and all these different images. And he seems very cool, but I think if he comes out with a big wet ballad, it's going to be a bit like, oh really, I had higher hopes than this. But obviously I'm not the target audience. But I read some interesting conspiracy theorying at the weekend. So his single was announced on March 25th, which is also the same day that Liam and Cheryl Cole announced the birth of their baby. March 25th, 2 years ago, was when Zayn left One Direction. March 25th last year was when Zayn released his debut solo album. So it definitely seems something pointed about them both choosing that date to make their announcement. I don't think it has any greater significance than that, but you know, it's some good fan insider baseball. I think it's satisfying to know.
Beware the 1Ds of March.
Yes. So Fraser, what would your most streamed song of the week be?
I've been listening to the new Future Islands song.
Bash to dust and trust to stress, red cheeks caved in.
The new song Cave, it plays on the thing that the growl in Samuel T. Harry's voice, which he sort of threw in at the end, by which time everybody was sort of mesmerized by him dancing, and then he does this growl thing and you're like, okay, what is happening now? But this is placed front and center in the middle of the chorus, and it's sort of my favorite thing that Future Islands do, because that saturated synth thing and the electro pop stuff is, oh, it's not really necessarily my bag. I kind of like, if I like electropop, I like it to be really melancholy with like the torch song over the torch singer over the top, like, you know, Yazoo or really, you know, super, super happy, like Just Can't Get Enough by Depeche Mode. You know, so it's really early days electropop stuff, but that's the way I like this, that sound. But this isn't that. But so to have that strange vocal quality to it, which is always like, what is this doing here? I think is kind of great.
I think it'll be interesting to see how that album pans out, because obviously that Seasons Waiting on You single made them so, so massive, and now I think they're headlining a festival or two this year, and they can draw a big crowd basically on the strength of one song and a very good album around it. But all their records before that had, you know, they had been quite different, and they'd shown massive progression between records. And you wonder how hemmed they will feel to following up Seasons when they're releasing their first album that's ever had like wider kind of public anticipation. It must be an awkward kind of position to be in.
Yes, and again, there is that suggestion, as we've talked about with Ed Sheeran's album, where people are consolidating a public view of what they're like. Which again, you know, why to use that growl so sort of prominently in the chorus is kind of great, because, you know, it's a subtle way of saying, yes, this is what we're like to an extent. We did write that song, and that's why we are where we are now. But we also put that bit at the end, and that wasn't a mistake. That wasn't just a burp that we left in. This is a noise that our singer definitely makes, and it's an integral part of what we do. It's funny, isn't it? Because you just get stuck on these kind of, are you going to do that again? Moments, and he did it again, and it's, you know, that automatically puts them, That and the funny dancing puts them head and shoulders above everybody else that's trying to make electropop.
My song of the week is Slip Away by Perfume Genius.
Baby, let all them voices slip away, yeah, yeah, yeah.
For ages, I've been, this is going to sound terribly pretentious, but I've been really annoyed by minimalism in minimalism in music, but also minimalism in like the outside world. As in, you can go to countries all around the world and you go and get a coffee and it's like, oh, really? You've got an exposed brick wall and some scaffolding shelves and some chalkboards and everything's kind of very rustic and pared back. Seeing like just like, this relentless minimalism everywhere just made me crave opulent. I want doilies and frills and pink and pelmets and
everything 24 karat.
Yeah, not quite everything 24 karat. A kind of like softer, more ridiculous, like pink opulence than that. And this Perfume Genius song, Slip Away, arrived at exactly the right time. It's so over the top and rushing. It's got like big frilly piano bits in it. It sounds like running through a jungle full of exotic birds while you're wearing a big sparkly cape. It's got a beautiful message to it. He's singing, if we never see them coming, then we never have to hide. It reminds me of how excessive and weird Kate Bush's album The Dreaming was. I think it is a perfect song. And I've had the album for a little while. It's not out till May. And I've had to restrict myself from listening to it because I've already heard it about 60 times because it's just so good.
Fantastic. So that's it for another week. Thank you very much for listening. Do keep sending us your ratings and comments and emails. Email us at unbreakmychartpod@gmail.com. And as always, you can contact us personally on Twitter. I'm at CSI_popmusic.
I'm at Laura Snapes.
And we will see you next week.